I'm Amanda Stevens, CEO of IPA Victoria. I'm back for my second hosting gig of the Public Sector Perspectives, our podcast channel profiling exceptional leaders and excellence across the public purpose sector in Victoria. Firstly, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land and the peoples of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. I recognise their continued connection to the land, waters and sea of this beautiful place. This episode continues our series celebrating recipients of IPA's most prestigious award, the Victorian Fellowship, in December 2023. IPA Victoria Fellowship is awarded annually to individuals who have provided an outstanding and exemplary contribution to the sector and who have demonstrated inclusive leadership. Today, I'm joined by Ella McPherson, Deputy Commissioner, Victorian Public Sector Commission. Ella joined the VPS in 2005 as a Senior Communications Advisor and has since worked across a wide range of portfolios and agencies, from community development, human rights, health, human services, to business and innovation, education and infrastructure. She joined the Commission in November 2021. Ella is a mentor of a number of VPS staff and convenes the VPS Deputy Secretary Disability Champions Roundtable. It's a warm welcome to you, Ella, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Amanda. Nice to meet you.
Ella, congratulations again on being awarded IPA Victoria Fellowship for 2023 for your long-term and ongoing commitment to the Victorian community. Can you tell our listeners a bit about your career journey, please?
It's a genuine honour getting the fellowship, and I'm not just saying that because I'm speaking to IPA, but because also I didn't mean to be a public servant. I'm certainly not, I wasn't a grad. I initially began as a journalist and then a consultant. And I did a communications master's in behaviour change and was going to go into, I guess, consulting and social marketing was my idea. And then I thought that I'd do an MBA next, and I genuinely joined government because I thought my hours would be better, quote unquote. That was in 2005, and I joined the now long defunct Department for Victorian Communities, where I was for some years. And then I went to the Equal Opportunity Human Rights Commission. I've worked in the Business and Innovation Department. I was then asked to head up communications for the then Department of Human Services, which mogged into DHHS. And after a couple of years there, I moved to education to lead some, I guess, cultural change work in response to the IBAC investigations that had hit education pretty hard. So after a few years doing that and some org reform, I've done everything, integrity and assurance, I ended up in ministerial services before moving to a completely new role as Chief Operating Officer of the School Building Authority, where we set up a new sort of portfolio management system and kept oversight of the school building program, which was interesting. Then, of course, COVID. And like everyone, got drawn into the COVID response in school operations and support, and was COVID commander. So I apologise to anyone who has children. It was us opening and closing schools and contact tracing and all those sorts of things. That was a large part of 2021. And then I took up my new role here in November 2021.
Ella, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your journalism early career and how it translates into public service. So what are the skills that journalism has taught you and how do they help you be a good public servant?
So I should say, first of all, that I was a journalist in the country, and the good bit about that is that you actually get to do everything. You don't end up just being the crime reporter or education or whatever it is. So the main thing it gives you, I think, is from a very young age, really, an ability to speak to a lot of different kinds of people and figuring out pretty quickly how you need to adapt to different communication styles. So it is quite different, talking to Mrs. Marsden down the road who accidentally grew a very giant sunflower without knowing versus a minister. So I think the adapting to different audiences is one thing. And then the other one really is just the ability to, capture information and make it really concise. You often have very little space to work in. And the old sort of, I guess, journalism mantra about you put the important things up front, it really helps with brief writing. So it's probably worth just having a look at the way that a good journo writes an article and have a think about how that applies to your brief. So what is the main point you need to get across, and just make sure that's pretty evident early. A lot of people spend too much time on the background. rather than getting to the point. So I think that's probably the key bit. The other one is deadlines, actually. Like they're immovable. The press is going to print, and you really have to be on time. They're all very good things to learn.
Yeah, excellent. And so I think, like, building on that, so you talk about speaking to a minister, and it occurs to me that you are somebody who has been in the room, either virtually or physically, with ministers and briefing them. And this is probably something that there's a lot of mystique about in the public service. What would you tell people about that helps them when they're considering writing a brief to a minister or even being in a meeting? How do they handle that interaction, and what are some of the common traps?
But the first one, because we run some executive forums on exactly this topic, and the main one is that they're people too. They really are. So, if you're being asked to write correspondence on their behalf, as boring as Corrie can be, it is actually really important. It is a letter from the Minister of the Crown to, a citizen of Victoria. So I think treating them like people is one thing, and that goes for their offices as well. People generally want to feel liked and respected. So occasionally, playing the "I'm the public service and you're the executive and you don't get to tell me what to do" card is probably not very helpful. So I've found really respectful relationships that are built on trust. I think if they can get to the point where they know that, 99 times out of 100, if they ask for something reasonable, you're going to be able to turn around and say, "Yes, I'll absolutely get on that," and that you deliver on that, means that every now and then when you have to explain to them why you can't do something, they're much more willing to listen to you. And then get the basics right. So I think in terms of briefs, we know that the thing that drives them absolutely up the wall are just poor quality briefs. They're hard to understand. They haven't got the information they need to make a decision, or they feel like they're being railroaded into that decision. So clear and respectful options and really considered advice, rather than either slightly patronising them. People don't mean to, but you can see that tone creep into a briefing occasionally. Or just assuming that you can kind of snow them with so much information that they're just going to agree to sign whatever it is. So it's just being considered and thinking about what you would want if you're at the other end of that.
Yeah, very interesting. So I note, as Deputy Commissioner of the VPSC and in previous roles at the Department of Education, you've worked on programs that are around delivering capability and especially integrity. So to ask the obvious question, why is it important for public sector professionals to lead with integrity, and how do organisations go about building positive integrity culture?
I guess the obvious one is it's the right thing to do. We're using public money. I think being very aware of that is always very important. And then there is the other obvious one, which is if you don't, you could get caught. And if you do that, it is not good for yourself. It is also very terrible for the agency that you work for. So, and I think the impact that it can have, having seen that firsthand, the impact it has on the entire organisation if they see their leadership fail, just can't be underestimated. It was pretty devastating for education. People that they'd, looked up to and trusted in many cases, really were found to be wanting. So I think the importance of leaders being able to demonstrate that they take it seriously, and that they will expect that of all their staff is genuinely paramount.
Very interesting. And I guess, look, building on that sort of leadership qualities, the theme there, what leadership qualities do you think are needed for a thriving public purpose sector?
I think the focus on, well, to remain with the integrity theme, I think the importance of being able to that tone from the top, again, can't be underestimated. So what I have seen work is an absolutely committed focus on integrity. You have to talk about it a lot and often and over a long, long period of time, much longer, I think, than people think they do. It's not one of those things where you can go, right, 2022 is the year of integrity, and then move on to the year of something else. So I think being able to actually to back that in, and for staff to genuinely see that you're creating a culture where they're free to speak up, I think is really important. The rest of the leadership qualities, I think, really are eternal, aren't they? They're about, I guess, being able to solve problems, bring people together, understand how to read and mitigate risk, and yeah, most importantly, they really bring people with you. I think that's eternal, I think, regardless of whatever the challenges are facing the sector.
Yeah, interesting. We could talk about that all day, about how you bring people with you. I guess somebody with a communications background probably has some pretty good insights into that.
A helpful start in life, I think, comps. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. And journalism, you share that with Simon Corden, who was my last interviewee on this podcast. So interesting. I didn't realize there was such a common thread there from journalism into the public service. In terms of key trends in the workplace or in the public sector, given your role in the commission, what are you seeing as the trends, in the current workplace?
The really obvious ones, I think, that most people would call out are, I mean, the huge shift post-pandemic to working from home and flex work. I think the focus that came out as well around really focusing on employee well-being, I think we've been talking about it for a long time. It's much more material now. And I think that we're getting much better research the further we get from the pandemic about the benefits and risks, I guess, of people working from home. So I think focusing on that provides its own challenges for leadership, that kind of hybrid, and particularly people like young people and people who are not getting the exposure. I think that's really important. AI, of course, artificial intelligence is the one everybody will name. I don't think anyone has quite figured out what to do with it. Both I guess, a threat. I was speaking to someone kind of fairly senior in this area a while ago who said probably it's getting to the point where AI can write briefs to the quality of, some of their sort of grade fours. So, we have to think about then how do you make the most of the stuff that still requires people and judgment and empathy and all those things that that AI has not managed to get yet.
Yeah, very interesting. And so in terms of staff and, how do they ready themselves for these kind of, working from home, wellbeing, AI challenges?
I think for staff, it really is about being quite deliberate about what you need, both for your longer term career and your kind of immediate well-being. I think it is very easy to get comfortable at home. We all have been. And equally, it's very easy for the extroverts to say, hey, why don't we get together more? So I think it's just about actively going through where the benefits of being together really are. I do think one of them, just personal observation, is that people in COVID, teams bonded quite strongly together. But often you start noting it across the organization, actually, some of the wheels fell off a bit. I think it's really hard to do that without being quite deliberate about what days you bring people together for what purpose. Otherwise, you can end up with these really tightly bonded units who don't necessarily integrate really well. And I think for AI, I think it's really, yeah, not being afraid of it, but really understanding how it can help, and making sure that it's doing the menial first draft kind of tasks for you. But that you actively are getting your staff to really read it and put their own, very human judgment over it, because you can end up with some pretty bad outcomes if you just cut and paste from the net.
Yeah, a bit of gobbledygook. Yeah, and stuff that's actually completely incorrect, I've seen as well, which is interesting.
That's true.
AI making stuff up. I didn't think that
Yes.
was possible, but they do, or it does, or
Well,
whatever.
it pulls from conspiracy theory websites as much as it will from sort of academic articles if you're not careful. So, yes, and also it's not necessarily current or up to date. So it's just, I think, really understanding what it is and what the limits are, and then really understanding where people still really are going to always matter, which is risk assessment, judgment, and understanding of your audience, which I would say as a comms person, but it's really
Yes.
important to know what they want to hear, not just what you want to tell them.
Yes, very important. Yeah, we could talk about sort of comms and, how to communicate with within the public service better all day. Couldn't we should do another podcast on that, I think, definitely. So the Victorian Ombudsman and IBAC's Operation Daintree have touched on, a couple of integrity issues recently, lots of people are talking about, and particularly the frank and fearless advice that public servants need to be able to give. Can you talk a bit about some of the ways the Commission sees that playing out and how your work might support that frank and fearless advice giving?
Absolutely. And those reviews, and particularly Daintree from IBAC, I think really highlight what can still go wrong when people are sort of meaning to do the right thing. And also when you have, I guess, a clash of our public sector values, one of which is responsiveness, which can then maybe make people a little bit quick to make decisions. So I think the kind of lesson from Daintree was really around relatively senior executives, and whether they, I suppose, felt able to have that kind of frank and fearless discussion with government, to provide advice that the office in that case didn't really particularly want to hear. We produced, and it was in the wake of initially the hotel quarantine inquiry. So some time ago, some guidance initially for secretaries and then an accompanying piece for other executives, on informing and advising ministers. And it might sound a bit cheesy, or like you're telling secretaries how to suck eggs, but one of the recos of the inquiry was that we issue guidance to make it really clear the obligation you have to set your advice down, to have it in writing. And you know, I think equally, public service has to remember that the government does not have to do what you recommend. It is okay for the minister to say no, but that should be on, I guess, the best advice, and then they can make the decision that they need to as the elected representative. But if you're not putting it in writing, there is no record of that decision, and it can end up, causing people a bit of grief.
Yes, and we saw a bit of that also in the pandemic, didn't we? The need to be really quick, but also the need to have integrity, which was, you would have seen it up close too, Ella. So IPA Victoria Fellowship Award honours long-standing individuals in the public purpose sector, and without being rude, you've had a long career and in the public sector. So why did you become a public servant, and why did you stay?
Well, it's a good question. As I said, I didn't mean to be. So I did it, but yeah, I came to do a business degree, really. And so that first role I did at the Department for Victorian Communities, we were driving around the state launching the government's new social policy initiative, A Fairer Victoria, which some people might remember, the first version. And I had the privilege of driving around with the Deputy Secretary for Community Development at the time, David Adams. And he said, "So what are you doing here?" And I said, "Oh, look, I'm a little bit embarrassed. I come from a private sector sort of family. No one's been a public servant in my family ever. And I'm just sort of here to study, And he said, "Look, you can think about government as a bunch of cardigan-wearing bureaucrats, or you can remember that every day it is the biggest business in the state with the biggest budget and the biggest impact on people's lives. How is that not the most interesting thing you could do?" And it does. It sounds a bit cheesy, but it got my little, 24-year-old self thinking. And it just really did reframe, I guess, how I thought about what I was doing and the contribution that the public sector made. So I finished those studies, and I remain here.
And isn't that fantastic? The accidental public servant, and what a contribution you've made that it's even recognised by IPA. So thank you for making the decision that you made. And I think it's incredible. And yeah, that the impact I think is the thing that drives most public servants. And I guess so. Look, question without notice. What is there anything, any impacts that you would be particularly proud of and want to call out that you've seen or been involved in?
I get asked that question quite a lot, what's your legacy? And I've been told that I need to be more ambitious about this. But I think what I'm most proud of, honestly, is the teams I've had, the people I've mentored, and watching them become better leaders. I still spend quite a lot of time speaking to a level or two below me to try and make sure that they can think differently about that role of kind of being a leader over and above being your technical specialist. So, yeah, I think the thing I'm proudest of is the people. Sounds terribly cheesy, but
No, I don't think it sounds cheesy at all. I think it sounds incredibly authentic and worthy. And I too, I think that's what drives most of the people that I talk to who are really passionate about public service. So look, thank you so much for your thoughtful responses, Ella. I feel like we could talk for a long time, but possibly we've already used up our time. So I will wrap it up there, unless there's any, earth-shattering thing that you'd like to say at the end here.
I guess the reason that I'm still here is, I hope, the reason most people are still here, and it is the people you work with. So you get to make an impact, but there's the most spectacular people in the public sector. I'm sure most of us could probably, I don't know, go and get a job at a bank or something. And none of us have chosen to do that because of, I guess, the people here and the difference you can make.
Yeah, definitely. Yes, absolutely. I think that's something that really resonates with me. So look, thank you so much for your time and your honest stories. Perhaps we'll have to do another one where you can tell us some more stories, from journalism through to travelling in the car with David Adams. I love that, the brown cardigan versus the biggest, budget and biggest impact in the state. I think that's fantastic, that story. We need
Been
to
ages since I've seen a cardigan, to be fair. They get a lot of bad press, but you don't get a lot of them appearing.
Yeah, although I think maybe it is the era of brown cardigan coming back, because I noticed that brown is the new colour, and I love a cardigan myself in the wintertime. Anyway, I'm going to be out and proud in my brown cardigan. But look, thanks so much, Ella. And I want to thank you from IPA and for the audience for your contribution today. It's been really lovely.
Thanks, Amanda.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To learn more about IPA Victoria, what we're doing and what kind of courses we provide, please have a look at our website, which is vicipaorg.au. So I will spell it vic.ipaa.org.au. Or you can stay in touch with us through LinkedIn, which is at IPAA Victoria. I'm Amanda Stevens. Thanks so much for listening.